Lecture 2, Northwestern University, Materials Science and Engineering 405, Physics of Solids, Professor Mark Persom, September 20th, 2006.
All right, let's get started. One bureaucratic detail, I'd like to introduce Dave Comstock, who's the other TA for this course. Dave, if you could briefly introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Dave. I'm a fourth year grad student, Professor Persom's group, and I have office hours on
Thursday morning?
Is it Thursday morning?
10 to 12.
Yeah, I'll check.
I believe. And it's in the teaching lab, just like Nathan Yoder's office hours. Okay, thanks, Dave. Last time, I gave you sort of an introduction to quantum, some of the interpretations of the wave function. It was mainly a qualitative / metaphysical or philosophical discussion. Today we're going to get a little bit more quantitative, and then the rest of the course will be much more quantitative. Are there any questions on Lecture 1 before we jump into it? Okay. If not, then let's proceed and think about some of the implications of the statistical interpretation of the wave function. In particular, the statistical interpretation implies that if we were to take the integral over all space of the magnitude squared of the wave function, remember this integral represents the probability of locating the particle between the bounds of the integral. If we're integrating over all space, then this probability must be equal to 1. That is, the particle must be somewhere, assuming that we're in a single universe situation. And that's the assumption we're going to make in this course. So if we have one universe, then that tells you that if you integrate over that universe, the particle must exist somewhere within it. This condition will therefore always be true and is known as the normalization condition. And it's basically a statement of the obvious, that the particle must exist somewhere. What's going to be typical in quantum mechanics is you'll be given a potential, you'll solve the Schrodinger equation, you'll have some boundary conditions, and typically you'll be short by one in terms of the boundary conditions necessary to find a unique solution. That final constant which remains in your solution, you can find by performing the normalization process. By this, I want you to recognize that because the Schrodinger equation is a linear differential equation, this implies that if we find some solution to that equation, capital Psi, so if capital Psi is a solution, then any multiple, so I'm having some arbitrary, in general, complex constant A times Psi, is also a solution. And this is obvious by inspection if you just look at the Schrodinger equation. As a result, what you would then do is, to find capital A, you'd plug in the solution you find, times A into this condition, set it equal to 1, and solve for A. And this will be the typical last step you'll do in any quantum mechanics problem. The normalization condition must be true for any physical solution of the Schrodinger equation. And as a result, it's evident that any solution to the Schrodinger equation that fails the normalization condition . This must be a non-physical solution, and thus must be rejected. This will be a typical constraint that we'll use to eliminate solutions to the Schrödinger equation. We'll often find a solution which may go as, say, e to the x and e to the minus x. Obviously, the e to the x solution, assuming that that solution is true for all values of x, will blow up as x goes to positive infinity. And so you would eliminate that solution based upon the fact that it fails this normalization condition. Similarly, the solution to the Schrödinger equation psi is equal to 0 certainly is always a solution to the Schrödinger equation, but it cannot be normalized, and therefore it's not physical. Strictly speaking, this implies that psi must go to 0 faster than 1 over the square root of the absolute value of x as the absolute value of x goes to infinity. Okay, I think that's obvious from elementary calculus. Obviously, something which went as e to the x or even proportional to x obviously would not go to 0 as x went to positive infinity and therefore would be ruled out as a solution to the Schrödinger equation. At least a physical solution to the Schrödinger equation. The point is, and many people will accuse this course of being a math course, but it's not really a math course because it's the physical constraints of the problem that will tell us which mathematical solutions are valid. And that's the heart of the problem. Performing the math is not really the point. The point is employing the appropriate physical constraints to the problem at the appropriate times in the mathematical solution. This will be the very useful trick for us as we try to solve these problems. So, with the normalization condition known, let's ask a reasonable question. If the wave function has been normalized, at t equals 0, will it remain normalized for future times? If it is not, then in principle we'd have to normalize the wave function for every value of time, and as a result that constant A would not be a constant at all, it would be a function of time, and as a result we'd have a problem. We'd no longer satisfy the Schrödinger equation. So this answer better be yes, that it does remain normalized for future values of time, but let's rigorously prove that statement. To do that, we have to show that the time derivative of this integral, the normalization integral, from minus infinity to infinity of the magnitude squared of psi dx has to equal 0. So that's what we're setting out to do. Can we prove that this time derivative is equal to 0? Of course, we can move this time derivative inside of the integrand. When we do that, of course, this total derivative will become a partial derivative, because while the definite integral is only a function of time, the integrand is a function of x and time. And so this will become the partial derivative with respect to time of the magnitude squared of psi dx. Let me remind you of what the magnitude squared of psi means. So this is a quick calculus reminder. The magnitude squared of psi is equivalent to taking the partial with respect to t of the complex conjugate of psi times psi. When you have the product of two functions, which are each a function of time, you have to apply the product rule in evaluating this derivative. And as a result, the derivative will be the first term, which is psi star, times the derivative of the second term, which is partial of psi with respect to t, plus the derivative of the first, which is partial psi star with respect to time, times the second, which is psi. Okay, so this term in the integrand is equal to these, the sum of these two terms here. To make progress, we need to employ additional information. And in particular, we know that the wave function satisfies the Schrodinger equation. And so we're going to go to the Schrodinger equation for inspiration. In particular, I'm going to take the Schrodinger equation and multiply it by negative I over h bar. And as a result, the Schrodinger equation will reduce down to partial of psi with respect to time is equal to I h bar over 2m times the second partial of psi with respect to x minus I over h bar v times psi. Of course, if this equation is true, its complex conjugate is also true. So if we take the complex conjugate, this equation, obviously each term needs to be taken, it has to have its complex conjugate taken. And as a result, this will be partial of psi star with respect to time is equal to the complex conjugate of I is negative I. Negative I times h bar over 2m times the second partial of psi star with respect to x, complex conjugate of negative I plus I over h bar times v times psi star. Now, one thing that I'm assuming here is that the potential v is real, and as a result, its complex conjugate is equal to itself. So this conclusion we're going to draw assumes that v is real. Fortunately, for 95% of the potentials we'll worry about in this course, the potential will be real, and as a result, this conclusion will be correct. However, if you had a physical process, for example, radioactive decay, where you know that the particle is going to decay as a function of time, and as a result, the probability of finding it will decay as a function of time, we can describe that quantum mechanically by utilizing an imaginary potential. So that's one possible example where you'd see an imaginary potential being utilized or present in quantum mechanics. But fortunately, in solid-state physics, V will almost always be real, and as a result, this conclusion will be correct.
Sorry, you were saying that one system, it's a radioactive decay?
I'm just saying, for example, if you had radioactive decay, then you'd expect there to be a decay in the probability of locating that particle as a function of time. So that's one example. In fact, if you're reading Griffiths in the back of Chapter 1, he cites that as a specific example. And so you can work that out if you're interested in that problem. I just pointed out to you because if you're watching carefully, you may have thought I was pulling a fast one on you by not taking the complex conjugate of V, but I'm assuming V is real, and as a result, the complex conjugate is equal to itself. Okay. So, what's the point? The point is that we can see that this term here falls right there in this equation. This term here falls right there in that equation. So if we were to plug those two in, what we would see is that we're going to get out a term which is going to be proportional to the second derivative of psi with respect to x. We're also going to get a term which is going to go as v times psi star. Similarly, with the second term, we're going to get out a term which goes as the second partial of psi star with respect to x. We'll also get out a term which goes as v times psi star times psi, but the sign is off. Right, this is negative and that's positive. And as a result, these cross terms are going to cancel. So if we were to plug the Schrodinger equation and its complex conjugate into this equation, the only terms that will survive are the second derivatives. Okay? I see some nodding heads, so I hope it's clear. What this implies, or what we conclude, is that the partial of psi, or I'm sorry, the time derivative of psi squared can now be expressed as I h bar over 2m times psi star times the second derivative of psi with respect to x minus the second derivative of psi star with respect to x times psi. All I've done is plug the Schrodinger equation and its complex conjugate into this equation and recognize that these terms are going to cancel. So all that survives are the second derivative terms. Okay, so are we making any progress? Possibly, if you recognize one more thing. In particular, this product here looks very similar to the results of a product rule, perhaps. And in particular, what we can do is write this down as the partial with respect to x of the quantity I h bar over 2m times psi star partial psi with respect to x minus partial psi star with respect to x times psi. Okay? Now this may or may not be self-evident. If you just perform the product rule twice in your head, hopefully you'll see it. In particular, if we were to take the spatial derivative of this product, what we'd get out is psi star times the second derivative of psi with respect to x, which is this term here, plus the partial derivative of psi star times psi, so that's a cross term. If we then take the partial derivative with respect to x of the second term, we get partial psi star with respect to x times partial psi with respect to x, which is a cross term, but now it's negative, so those two are going to cancel one another, minus the second partial of psi star with respect to x times psi, which is the second term here. So hopefully it's clear that this is equivalent to that. Is it okay? All right. Why this matters is because what we're ultimately trying to calculate is not the time derivative of psi squared, but the integral of that time derivative. The integral of a derivative is, of course, the argument of that derivative. So now we can write down directly what that integral is equal to. So we therefore conclude that d dt of the integral from minus infinity to infinity of psi squared dx will just be equal to this argument of this derivative integrated or evaluated at minus infinity and plus infinity. And as a result, this just equals I h bar over 2m times psi star partial psi with respect to x minus partial psi star with respect to x times psi evaluated at minus infinity and plus infinity. Now we have to recall this statement here where we said that the wave function must go to zero as the absolute value of x goes to infinity. And as a result, this term has to go to zero, and this term has to go to zero at plus infinity and minus infinity. And as a result, this equation here is simply equal to zero. Okay. So since psi, and therefore psi star, goes to zero as the absolute value of x goes to infinity, we can see that this term on the right-hand side must be equal to zero, and as a result, the time derivative of the integral from minus infinity to infinity of psi squared dx has to equal zero, which therefore shows that this statement here is true. Obviously, if the time derivative is zero, that means it's constant as a function of time. So if you normalize at any value in time, the wave function will remain normalized for all future values of time. The only assumption you have to make is that the potential is real. Okay. So this is, I think, a nice derivation because it shows how we have to utilize, first of all, the Schrodinger equation. The Schrodinger equation is always true, and so whenever you get stuck in a problem, you should go back there. That's a good place to go. Secondly, we have to recognize some properties of the wave function which are a direct consequence of the statistical interpretation of the wave function. So there's obviously some math here, some partial derivatives, some product rule, basic calculus, but also there's physical properties which we have to inject into the problem to solve it. Okay. So this is a theme which is going to be followed throughout the course. And really, that's the value of any quantitative solution to a physical problem, which you'll find in any quantitative material science course, is the ability, of course, to execute math, but more importantly, to inject physics into the problem at the appropriate time. And so even if your thesis work has nothing to do with quantum mechanics, I hope you'll at least learn the approach we're taking here, because it applies to any quantitative problem, any quantitative modeling, which is certainly expected in any material science PhD thesis. Okay. Is everybody okay with this normalization discussion? Okay. If so, let's move on to the next topic. In quantum mechanics, we define a term called the expectation value. The expectation value is also the average value which is different than the most probable value . So the expectation value in particular of x is represented as these angular brackets around x. And it's just an integral from minus infinity to infinity of x times the magnitude squared of psi dx. This term expectation value is certainly the nomenclature which is popularly used, but it's kind of a misnomer in that you would think that the expectation value would represent the most likely result of an experiment. But it's not. It's the average value of an experiment. So think of this as a mean or an average, not as a most probable result. The most probable result you can determine by finding the maximum, the absolute maximum, of the magnitude squared of psi times the relevant differential volume element. That is, if you plotted psi squared versus x in this case, the peak in that function would be the most probable value you'd get in a measurement, but not necessarily the average value you'd get in a measurement. Okay, I think we all know this from elementary statistics. So this is what the expectation value is known as. One thing I should point out, though, is that since the magnitude squared of psi and therefore, since psi itself is time dependent, and therefore in general the magnitude squared of psi will also be time dependent, then the average value of x will change with time. There will be some special cases where we'll find that the magnitude squared of psi is time independent, and as a result, x will similarly be time independent. These will be known as stationary states. We'll cover them in the next lecture. But in general, psi is time dependent, and in particular, psi squared is time dependent, and as a result, x will change with time. Since the expectation value of x will change with time, we should be able to calculate its time derivative. So let's do that. We're going to take the time derivative of the expectation value of x. Incidentally, at this point in Griffiths and similarly in the notes, I'm going to abandon writing down the bounds of the integral from minus infinity to infinity over and over. That is, assume I'm just suppressing it for simplicity. Obviously, in this case, integral would have to be evaluated from minus infinity to infinity. So I'm suppressing those bounds. The time derivative of this will therefore be equal to x times partial with respect to t of psi squared dx. We already know that the partial with respect to t of psi squared is already calculated for us. It's the first spatial derivative of that difference which we just determined. So we can plug this in to the integral directly. This will be equal to, if we see up above, I h bar over 2m times the integral of x times the partial with respect to x of psi star times partial psi with respect to x minus partial psi star with respect to x times psi dx. Now, when you have an integrand which looks like this, which is some function times the derivative of a function, this should scream at you integration by parts. And as a result, we will integrate this by using the technique of integration by parts. So at least in high school, when I was taught integration by parts, we would use these two terms, u and dv. And so I'm going to let u equal x and dv equal partial with respect to x of psi star, partial psi with respect to x minus partial psi star with respect to x times psi dx. So we're trying to integrate u dv. To do that, we take the derivative of u. So du is simply dx, because the derivative of x is 1. We have to integrate dv, but that's the beauty of this. The integral of this function is just the argument of its derivative. And as a result, v is just psi star, partial psi with respect to x, minus partial psi star with respect to x times psi. And if you recall, when you do integration by parts, the integral of u dv is equal to u times v minus integral of v du. Obviously, you have to evaluate u times v at the bounds of the integral, which means we're going to evaluate u times v at plus infinity and minus infinity. But we already know from our statistical interpretation of the wave function that psi and psi star go to 0 at plus or minus infinity. And as a result, u times v is equal to 0. So all that remains is therefore the integral of minus v du. And as a result, this dx, the expectation value of x dt will just be equal to negative I h bar over 2m times the integral of v du. V is just psi star partial psi with respect to x minus partial psi star with respect to x times psi dx. Okay. Now you have to be a little bit more clever and recognize that to make progress on this particular integral, a clever approach would be to integrate only the second term by parts. Okay. So we're just going to integrate the second term by parts. And recognize that u is psi, du is therefore partial psi with respect to x, dv is negative partial psi star with respect to x dx, and therefore v is just negative psi star. Obviously, this integral would therefore become u times v, which is just psi times psi star, evaluated at the bounds, which is of course 0, as before, minus v du. V du is just psi star times partial psi with respect to x, which is exactly the first term. And as a result, this difference will simply be equal to twice the value of the first. 2 times 1 half is 1, and as a result, this integral is just minus I h bar over m times the integral of psi star partial psi with respect to x dx. So this is the time derivative of the expectation value of x. Of course, the time derivative of a spatial coordinate is just its velocity. So this integral represents the expectation value of the velocity of the particle. Obviously, this is only relevant when the position of the particle is moving as a function of time, which would be true for a time-dependent potential. If you, on the other hand, you have a time-independent potential which has a stationary state solution such that psi star is time-independent, then obviously this time derivative would be equal to zero and there would be no velocity. And that's why it's known as a stationary state because it's not moving. Okay. So hang on, we are getting somewhere. In particular, now that we've evaluated the expectation value of the velocity, we can immediately write down what the expectation value of the momentum is. Momentum from classical physics is just mass times velocity, that is mass times the time derivative of the spatial coordinate x. And as a result, the expectation value of momentum would just be mass times this term here. So you can see by inspection that the expectation value of momentum is just going to be negative I h bar times the integral of psi star partial psi with respect to x dx. The good news is that we've now identified the quantum mechanical definition, if you will, or quantum mechanical perspective on momentum. So what we want to find is the expectation value of momentum. Which will be p in brackets. This is obviously mass times the expectation value of velocity, which is just the mass times the time derivative of the expectation value of x, which we already calculated. And as a result, as I just stated, the expectation value of momentum is just negative I h bar times the integral of psi star partial psi with respect to x dx. Equivalently, and perhaps suggestively, let me now write down that the expectation value of x is just equal to an integral of psi star times x times psi dx. The expectation value of momentum p is just the integral of psi star h bar over I partial with respect to x, psi dx. And as a result, we're going to call this term in the middle of psi star and psi within this integral over all space an operator. Okay, so I'm introducing some new nomenclature here. The position operator, and these operators will often go by hat, so x hat, the position operator, is simply x. So we put x sandwiched between psi star and psi, integrate over all space. The momentum operator p hat is just h bar over I partial with respect to x. So once we know what the operator is, we can determine its expectation value just by sandwiching it between psi star and psi and integrating over all space. Obviously, this operator operates on the function to its right, so this spatial derivative is operating on psi in this case. So you have to obviously execute that partial derivative before you can integrate. The expectation value of any quantity q, which will have to be a function of x and p, is therefore denoted as angular brackets Q will be equal to, by analogy, psi star times Q of X H bar over I partial with respect to X times psi dx. Right, because the momentum operator is H over I partial with respect to X. So, for example, let's calculate the expectation value of kinetic energy . So kinetic energy is T. Kinetic energy is, of course, 1 over 2m times P squared. P squared will therefore be equal to negative H bar squared times the second partial with respect to X. So this equals negative H bar squared over 2m times the integral of psi star times partial psi with respect to X, dx. This term here, negative h bar squared over 2m times second partial psi with respect to X, should look very familiar, because it's the first term on the right-hand side of the Schrodinger equation. If you recall, last time I was calling that kinetic energy. Hopefully now it's obvious why I was doing that. Okay. Everybody comfortable with expectation values, the mathematics, etc.? Okay. If so, what I'd like to do is take a look at a figure. This figure is depicting a wave, and it's depicting a classical wave. So you can see it's a picture of a guy or a woman grabbing a rope and wiggling it. And there's two extreme cases shown here. One is the case where the excitation is oscillatory and continues for some extended period of time. And if you do that, you'll set up a standing wave on your string. The second case is one where you just wiggle it once, and you have one wiggle, which then propagates down the string. Okay, so this is true for a string which is being oscillated. It would be true for an electromagnetic wave. It's true for all waves, including quantum mechanical waves. In fact, the Schrodinger equation is basically just the wave equation, which you've probably seen previously in electromagnetism. In fact, the Schrodinger approach to quantum mechanics is often known as wave mechanics, because it's basically taking the wave perspective on the problem and directly results from de Broglie waves, which was a predecessor to the Schrodinger equation. The point is that the top wave, figure 1.7, you can clearly see what the wavelength of that wave is. However, if I was to ask you where it is located in space, that'd be a difficult question to answer because it's obviously distributed over the length of the string. On the other hand, the second figure, figure 1.8, the wave is clearly located in one position. You can see where it is. But what is its wavelength? We're only seeing one half of the period, whereas the other half, the wavelength is obviously poorly defined in that case. This is true for all waves, including a string, including water waves, including electromagnetic waves, and also including quantum mechanical waves. The fact is that there's this inherent uncertainty which exists between wavelength and position for any wave. What I'm leading to is the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, which is not that mysterious. When I first introduced it to undergraduates, it's often deemed to be mysterious because there's no classical analog. But actually, it's just a consequence of the wave-like nature of particles. which is true for a quantum mechanical system. All waves have this inherent uncertainty. In fact, if you were to perform Fourier analysis on any wave, you would learn immediately that there's an inherent uncertainty in its position and its wavelength. So Fourier analysis, you can come up with a rigorous proof of this very qualitative picture. Okay, everybody comfortable with this? To rigorously prove the Heisenberg uncertainty principle is a dicey matter. It requires the matrix formulation of quantum mechanics known as matrix mechanics, which I don't cover in this course because it requires a lot of linear algebra, which I'm sure we could all do, but would take a lot of time to go over. It's all captured in Chapter 3 of Griffiths. So if you're interested in that formulation and to have a more rigorous proof, if you will, of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, then I refer you to that chapter. Today I'm just asking you to accept that that picture I just showed you is true for all waves, and as a result would apply to quantum mechanical waves. Of course, in quantum mechanics, waves and particles are not well defined, and wave-particle duality is something which we all have to embrace. So basically, any quantum mechanical particle will have a wave-like nature to it, and therefore will have to obey the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. Okay. So as I mentioned, rigorous Fourier analysis would show that there's this inherent uncertainty between position and wavelength for any wave. And of course, this uncertainty applies to the wave function itself. Furthermore, I'm asking you to pull out something from your memory banks, that the momentum of a so-called de Broglie wave is equal to Planck's constant divided by the wavelength. That's, of course, equivalent to 2 pi times h bar over lambda. This is the de Broglie formula. Which we teach here at Northwestern in freshman level physics. The de Broglie formula tells us that the spread in wavelength, the inherent uncertainty in wavelength, which we just talked about and looked at in figures 1.7 and 1.8, implies that there must also be a spread in momentum, or an uncertainty momentum. Okay, so this is a qualitative argument. Quantitatively, this is embodied in the following equation. Sigma x, the standard deviation in position, times sigma p, the standard deviation in momentum, has to be greater than or equal to h bar over 2. This is the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. Qualitatively, it results from this general result of Fourier analysis that any wave has this uncertainty in position and wavelength, and furthermore recognizing that for de Broglie waves, position and momentum are intimately related, and as a result, uncertainty in wavelength implies an uncertainty in momentum. Strictly speaking, it follows this equation here, which, as I said before, could be derived using linear algebra and matrix mechanics in Chapter 3 of Griffiths. Here I'm just asserting it, and let me define or remind you how to calculate standard deviations. So standard deviation is equal to the square root of the expectation value squared minus the expectation value of x squared Okay. standard deviation in momentum is just the square root of the expectation value of momentum squared minus the expectation value of momentum squared. Okay, these are statistical definitions of standard deviation, which we're usually all familiar with from standard deviations being given out on bell curves and classes and that type of thing. Of course, expectation values have a clear definition in quantum mechanics. So to actually evaluate the uncertainty in x and the uncertainty in momentum, you have to execute two different integrals and take their difference, take the square root. And so this is very clearly defined. It's just a matter of executing some integrals to calculate it. Whenever you have found a solution to the Schrödinger equation, you can go ahead and calculate the expectation value of x squared and the expectation value of x, and similarly p squared and p, plug them into these equations, and verify that the uncertainty principle holds. The uncertainty principle always holds, and if you find that it does not, then clearly your solution is invalid. Question? No question. Okay. I should point out, just as a concluding thought, that there are other Heisenberg uncertainty pairs. So the uncertainty principle holds for other incompatible observables. A famous one is energy and time. The uncertainty principle, I think, is your best guide in developing intuition for quantum mechanics. When in doubt, if someone asks you a qualitative question in quantum mechanics, you'll want to go to the Heisenberg uncertainty principle and you'll probably get the answer right. If you go back to classical physics for intuition, you'll almost always be wrong. For example, if I was to tell you I had a solution to the Schrödinger equation which was time independent, that would tell you that you would know nothing about its time. You know nothing about what time that wave function is describing, because it's time independent. Any value of time would be valid. As a result, the uncertainty in time is infinite, if you will, for a time-independent solution. That tells you that the uncertainty in energy is probably very low. That is, you know a lot about the energy. And in fact, for wave functions where we know nothing about time, these will also be known as the stationary state solutions, we will know the energy exactly. So that's a case where we can use Heisenberg uncertainty principle to deduce that a time-independent solution will have a very definite energy. This is good because it's going to imply that there are some things which we do know definitely in quantum mechanics. For example, the binding energy of an electron to the proton in the hydrogen atom is a definite energy, 13.6 electron volts. We can see that while quantum mechanics does require you to embrace uncertainty, some things will be certain, and those will be the measurables which we'll seek. The beauty of it is that no matter when you measure the hydrogen atom, you'll always get 13.6 electron volts. Whereas it seemed when I first started the course that there'd be measurements where we'd only be able to get a statistical answer. There will be some measurements which are a definite answer, and those will be the easiest ways to verify and test that quantum mechanics is an accurate theory. Fortunately, in solid-state physics, there are many other definite measurables which we can pull out. For example, the band gap of silicon is something which will result from quantum mechanics ultimately. That's going to be something which is a result of a stationary state solution of the Schrödinger equation, and as a result, that energy will be a fixed value. So there's hope for us. We'll continue next time.
MSE 405.